Thank you. Hi, everybody. My name is David A., and I'm an alcoholic. And only because of God's grace through the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have not found it necessary to. And I have taken a drink of an alcoholic nature since April the 20th, 1967, and for this I am so thankful. And my role this day will be to share AA's experience, beginning first with our heritage, and that is actually in a lot of history. And the first will be the writing of our book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And then, after that, why the second legacy, with a lot of history in it, and the reasons for our being. Because we all have to remember, as I said last night, that no one speaks for Alcoholics Anonymous as a whole. No one has that right, no one has that authority, and no one's been so designated. We're just simply asked to share our experiences and not our opinions, because we find as a result of our experiences in Alcoholics Anonymous that opinions in many, many instances have a tendency to make sick people sicker, and in some instances to physically kill people. We're not here to kill people. We're here to help people. Now, I know there's been a little conversation about the size of the crowd. Well, I'll tell you right now, I've been raised in AA maybe a little different. I've always been told, don't count them, tend to them. That's the main thing. I don't know about anybody here, but I'm here for David's sobriety. If I was here for any other reason, I'd be lying to you, and it would be ego, and it would be something else. God knows I have enough of that ego as it is. But staying sober is the name of the game. Now, you know, the writing of the Book of Alcoholics Anonymous is nothing more than just a series of stories that cluster around the writing of the Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the talking about writing a book first started in the living room of Dr. Bob and Annie Smith in Akron. And Bill had landed in Akron in the summer of 1935. And a little group caught hold, and Bill helped Dr. Bob briefly with it. And Dr. Bob and Bill went on to found what we call now the first AA group now in the world. Now, in those days, it was not known as Alcoholics Anonymous. It was just a group of anonymous alcoholics trying to help somebody or help each other, mainly to stay sober. And as it was with new groups, it was always nearly all failure, but now and then somebody would see the light and there was progress. And Bill went back to New York City and with a little experience and started a group in New York City called the Manhattan Group. And by that time, 1937 rolled around, AA spread into Cleveland and began to move south from New York City and began to move north from New York City. And as a result of it, but it still was in those days more or less flying blind. A flickering candle, indeed, that at any moment could be snuffed out. Well, on a late fall afternoon in 1937 in Akron, Dr. Bob and Bill were talking in Dr. Bob's living room, and they began to count sober noses. How many people had stayed dry in Akron, in New York, and maybe a few in Cleveland? How many had stayed dry and for how long? And when all this was totaled up, sure, it was just a handful, 35 or 40 maybe. But enough time had elapsed on really enough fatal cases and tough cases of alcoholism so that when Bill and Bob grasped the impact of those small statistics, Bill and Bob saw for the first time, really, that this thing was going to succeed, that God in His mercy and had thrown a new light into the dark caves and tunnels where our kind had been and were living by the millions, and they're still by the millions existing in this world today. You'd be surprised how many problem drinkers and their families have never heard of Alcoholics Anonymous. With all of our public information and all of our television and radio spots, The problem drinker, he's not watching television. He turned on one of those spots, are you having trouble with alcohol? If he doesn't have a clicker, he'll cut the machine off. He doesn't want to hear it. He doesn't want to look at it. He doesn't want to see it. Families still today don't want people to know that they've got our kind living in the family and causing havoc and violence and everything in this God's world. And so, Bob and Thrill, when they saw those statistics, they began talking and reflecting that even though a couple of score of sober members had taken 3 long years, sure, there was a lot of failures, but it had taken 3 long years to sober up only a handful. Now, how could this handful carry its message to all of those who still did not know? And after all, not all of the drunks in the world could come to Akron or to New York City. So how could they transmit this message to them, and by what means? And Bill and Bob thought that maybe they should go to the old-timers in the groups. Well, in those days, everybody was an old-timer. A drunk would come in and get sober. 2 days, a new one come in. The one sober 2 days would be the new one's sponsor. And then the sponsor would get drunk, and the new one would be his sponsor. And then, and above all, find a sum of money. Naturally, somebody else's money. And say to them, now you take a year off your job, if you have a job. And you go to all the parts of the country during the year and help get groups started. Because hospitals in those days were not too happy with drunks. They'd put the drunk in what they call under medical or for stomach trouble. And they'd put them in those hospitals, and they'd be in their little old shark kimonos, and they'd start firing up cigarettes and getting up and drinking all the rubbing alcohol they could get their hands on, and wander up and down the hall 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, terrorizing the nurses and hollering and screaming and terrorizing the heart patients. And as a result of it, it was obvious to those that drunks being such unloving characters, then they would, as a result, then Dr. Bob realized they're going to have a great chain of hospitals. Sort of like chain drug stores, chain grocery stores, chain department stores. Because those of you who are old enough remember back in the 30s, the chain drug stores and the grocery stores, they're the only ones that were making money during the Depression. And so as a result, why not have a chain of drunk tanks? And then they could really make the money. So they decided they need to have some missionaries. Now you have to remember in those days, they talked about being missionaries, and they didn't talk about making talks, they talked about testifying. And all these because they stem from a very, very halfway religious background in those days. And then as far as they're concerned, and Bill being the Wall Street promoter and far more insistent about those needs of drunk tanks and missionaries than Dr. Bob. And after all, it would take a lot of money to finance all this. And after all, with this brand new light shining in this dark world, all they'll have to do is go squirt it in the eyes of the rich and then kick in with the money. And besides, they also reflected they were going to have a stand of some kind of literature. Now, up to this moment, not a syllable, not a single word of what we now, our program, was in writing. It was sort of a word or mouth deal with variations according to each man or woman's fancy. Now, in those days, they didn't have women. In a general way, this was the pitch. Now, it's utterly amazing. They're circulating around some Xerox copies of the 6 steps that Bill wrote and signed his name with his date on it. And then there are also what used to be the 6 steps of the Oxford Movement. And AA comes of age and pass it on, and as Bill sees it, and they'll vary, because after all, it had to do with a lot of memory with a lot of people, but this was a general pitch. Booze has got you down, and if you have an allergy and an obsession, and you're hopeless. And if you are, then you better get honest with yourself. Take stock, and you ought to talk this out with somebody. And you ought to make restitution for the harms you did, and you ought to make amends. And you prayed the best you could according to your belief, if you had any. That was the sum of the word-of-mouth program up to that time. Now, variations of that was already appearing. And so they began to reflect, how could we unify this thing? Could they, out of their experience, get certain principles, describe certain methods that had done the job for them? So it became obvious that if this movement was to propagate, it had to have literature, so its message could not be garbled either by the drunks or by the general public. And one of the biggest concerns that we have in AA today, that our message is being garbled. And that was the whole purpose of the Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, so that it would be very explicit as a result of only one thing, and that is experience. So missionaries, a chain, and a bunch of drunk tanks, and a book. And even at that early date, both Bill and Dr. Bob began to learn that they were not the government of Alcoholics Anonymous. Bob, perhaps more so than Bill, already realized that the conscience of the group, the opinion of the group, when it was an informed opinion, in the group's best interest, it could be better than both Dr. Bob and Bill's. So they thought it would be better to consult people. There was a non-alcoholic by the name of T. Henry Williams, and his wife let the Akron Bunch meet in their house. And so a meeting was called in the of the Akron group, that is those who had been sober any length of time. And they managed to scrape up about 18. And Bill and Bob told them that they were within sight of success, and they thought that this deal would go on and on and on and on, that a new light was shining in their dark world, but how could this light be transmitted without being distorted and garbled? At this point, the meeting that was turned over to Bill, and Bill being a salesman and a promoter, he set right to work on about those drunk tanks and subsidizing for the missionaries, and they touched on maybe the book just a little. And the group conscience, which consisted of 18 men, were darn skeptical about it all. And almost with one voice, they shouted, "Let's keep it simple. This is going to bring money into this thing. This is going to create a professional class, and we'll all be ruined." Bill countered by admitting that their arguments had merit, but he also reminded them that alcoholics were dying like flies, and so how are they going to carry this message to others? He reminded them that they had to take some kind of chances. He said, "We can't keep it so simple that it becomes an anarchy and thus gets complicated, and we can't keep it so simple that it will not propagate itself, and that we're going to have a lot of money to do these things." And after Bill had exerted his conning to the utmost, they finally got a vote in that meeting, and a close vote at that, by just a majority of 2 or 3. And then the meeting turned to Bill and said, with some reluctance, "Well, if we need a lot of money, you better go back to New York City where that's where all the money is, and there's plenty of it, and you raise it." Well, that's exactly what Bill wanted to hear. That's what he had been waiting for. So he scrambled back to the Big Apple, and he began to approach some people with money and to describe this tremendous thing that had happened, but it didn't seem so tremendous to people with money at all. "Why," they said, "Mr. Wilson, 35 or 40 drunks sobered up. They've been sobered up before now and then, and besides, Mr. Wilson," they told him, "don't you think that this is kind of sweeping up the crumbs? Wouldn't something for the Red Cross or the Salvation Army or for the churches be better?" And with all of Bill's cunning, he got one heck of a freeze from the gentleman of wealth. Things were tough in New York City. They were starving to death on Clinton Street. Drunks were eating the Wilsons out of house and home, for in those days they never charged anybody anything. And Bill's wife, Lois, was working and earning the money, the only one that was working in New York with that bunch. And Bill was being a missionary, and the drunks were eating the meals. And that couldn't go on. And Bill kept plugging away to get them darn drunk tanks. "We got to have them missionaries, and we have to have a book." Well, one morning, Bill called on his brother-in-law physician by the name of Dr. Leonard Strong, and he began to bellyache about how those rich guys wouldn't give him any money. This great and glorious enterprise that was well on its way. It seemed, however, that Dr. Strong, when he was in high school, dated a girl, and her girl had an uncle. and that this uncle was tied up with the Rockefeller family and all their charities. And he asked Bill if he wanted to, let's call up the Rockefeller offices and see if there is such a man, and if he is there, is he still alive, and will he see us? Well, Bill hadn't tried the Rockefeller offices yet, so they agreed to give it a ring. Oh, on what slender threads our destiny sometimes hang. Remember, Bill's brother-in-law said he dated a girl, and she had an uncle with a Rockefeller. So the call was made, and the voice came on the wire, the voice of Mr. Willard Richardson, one of the loveliest gentlemen that Bill and Bob and Alcoholics Anonymous would know, because Mr. Richardson was John D. Rockefeller Jr.'s personal executive secretary and also his spiritual advisor. And the moment he recognized Bill's brother-in-law's voice, he said, "Why, Leonard, where have you been all these years?" And after a few exchanges, Dr. Strong explained to Mr. Richardson that he had a brother-in-law who was having success in sobering up drunks. And could the two of them come over and see him? "Sure," said Mr. Richardson, "come right over." So they went over to the Rockefeller Plaza and took the elevator right into the John D. Rockefeller Jr.'s personal offices and asked to see Mr. Richardson. And after meeting Mr. Richardson, Bill sat down and told him about their exciting discovery, this terrific cure for alcoholism that had just hit the world, how it works and what they had done. And this was the first receptive man with access to money, and above all, perhaps John D. Rockefeller Jr.'s best personal friend. So Mr. Richardson said, "Why, yes," he was much interested. Then he asked Bill to have lunch with him. And for a rising promoter, Bill thought things were looking up. And during lunch, they go over the deal again. And after lunch, he asked Bill if he would like to have a larger meeting with some of Mr. Richardson and Mr. Rockefeller's friends. And he said there's Mr. Frank Amos, who's in the advertising business. And he was on the committee that recommended to John D. Rockefeller Jr. to drop this business of prohibition business that he was getting involved in. And then there was Mr. Leonard Chipman. He looked after all of the Rockefeller real estate. And then there's Mr. Scott, chairman of the board of the Riverside Church, and a number of people like that, that he believed that would like to hear the story that Bill was telling. And so on a winter's night, a meeting was held in December, the first part of December of 1937, and called in post haste for this meeting a couple of drunks and Dr. Bob from Akron with a couple of drunks. And Bill came in with the New York bunch, four or five. The meeting was held at Mr. Rockefeller's personal boardroom, and Bill really got excited when he was told that he was sitting in a chair that had just been vacated about an hour previous to that by John D. Rockefeller Jr. And Bill, when he sat in the chair, he could feel that just money just coming right up his hip into his hip pocket, and he'd start getting excited. And Dr. Silkworth was also there, and he testified what he had seen happen. And each drunk, thinking of nothing better to say, each told their story of drinking and their recovery. And still today, the best thing that any of us can say is just simply our story of what it used to be like, what happened, and our recovery. And that is where the format for our talks began. And after seeing that these new good friends were interested, Bill naturally started putting on the big touch of bringing up the subject of drunk tanks, subsidized missionaries, and this question of book or literature and money. Well, God moves in mysterious and wondrous ways, you know, but it certainly didn't look like a wonder to Bill when Mr. Scott, head of a large engineering firm, chairman of the Riverside Church, looked at this bunch of drunks and said, "But gentlemen, up to this point, this has been the work of goodwill only. No buildings, no property, no paid people. Just one carrying the good news to the next. Is that not true?" And then he dropped his bombshell, and may it not be that that is where the great power of your society will lie. Now, if we subsidize this, might it not alter its whole character? We want to do all we can. We are gathered here for that. But would it be wise? Then all the drunks gave Mr. Scott the rush and said, there are only 40 of us, and it's taken 3 long years. Why, millions will rot before this thing gets to them, unless we have money and lots of money. So one of the businessmen there volunteered to investigate them very carefully. And since poor old Dr. Bob was harder up at that time than Bill, and since the first group was in a typical community situation in Akron, the drunks directed their to this businessman's attention out there. And Frank Amos, who later became a trustee on the old Alcoholic Association, which was named later the Alcoholic Foundation, which was changed later to the General Service Board of Alcoholics Anonymous in its name, at his own expense, went out to Akron, made all of the inquiries about Dr. Bob, and all of the reports were good, except that he was a drunk who had recently gotten over it. He visited the little meeting out there, he went to the Smith's house, and he came back with what he thought was a very modest project. And he recommended that they could recommend a token amount of money at first, $50,000. Now you have to remember, that was a token amount of money to the Rockefellers. It's just like quarters in our pockets, you know. And they take the $50,000, and he said that would clear off the mortgage on Dr. Bob's home, and then we'd get the, so he could take the financial pressure off of that, and then we'd get the drunks in Akron a little rehabilitation place, put Dr. Bob in charge, and subsidized a few of those people, and then start a chain of hospitals and a few missionaries, and then get busy on the book and so forth. However, Mr. Richardson took that report into John D. Rockefeller Jr.'s office, and he took it to Mr. Jr., and they used to call him Jr., who read the report, and he told Mr. Richardson, somehow I'm strangely stirred by all this. This interests me immensely. And then he dropped his bombshell. But isn't money going to spoil this thing? I'm terribly afraid that it would. And yet I am so strangely stirred by it. The next turning point came in our destiny when that man whose business was giving away money said to Mr. Willard Richardson, no, I will not be the one to spoil this thing with money. You say these men who are heading it are strapped for cash? I'll put $5,000 in the Riverside Church treasure. You folks can form yourself into a committee and draw on it as you like, but please don't bother me anymore. But I want to hear what's going on. Well, the $50,000 had shrunk to $5,000. The drunks paid off the mortgage on Dr. Bob's house. That took about $3,000, and that left $2,000. And Bill and Dr. Bob start eating away at that. And then what they going to do now? Well, they had more meetings with their new friends, Amos, Richardson, Scott, Chipman, and those fellows who stuck with the drunks from then on. And in spite of Mr. Rockefeller's advice, the drunks again tried to convince Mr. Rockefeller's friends, and they got a list from John D. Rockefeller of everybody who he knew or who they thought he even knew, and that this thing needed a lot of money. So one of them proposed that they form a foundation, something like the Rockefeller Foundation. And so one of them got a free lawyer from Elihu Root's firm, which at that time was one of the most prestigious law firms in the world, this lawyer was interested in this thing. And the drunks asked him to draw up an agreement of trust, a charter for something to be called the Alcoholic Foundation. Now, why they picked that name, Alcoholic Foundation, even Bill didn't know. The lawyer, however, was much confused, because in the meeting in which the foundation was formed, the drunks made it very clear that the drunks did not wish to be in the majority. They felt that there should be non-alcoholics on the board, and they ought to be, and the non-alcoholics ought to be in a majority of one. Well, the drunks were no fools. The reason that they want to have more non-alcoholics on the board is so that if all the drunks on the board got drunk, they could still have a quorum and have a board meeting. Sure, said the lawyer. Then he asked this question, well, what's the difference between an alcoholic and a non-alcoholic? Well, there's always a smart drunk around, and one of them said, well, that's a cinch. A non-alcoholic is a guy who can drink, and an alcoholic is a guy who can't drink. Well, if you'd like to know how it's stated legally, it's in the bylaws of the General Service Board in the service manual, and it talks about those who partake of the use of alcoholic beverages are classified as alcoholics, and those who didn't and have not been afflicted with illness aren't. And that's how you say it legally. Well, said the lawyer, how do we state that legally? And I told him that, and no one knew how they knew. So at length they had a foundation and a board, which then consisted of about seven, consisting of four of their new non-alcoholic friends and three of the drunks. And Dr. Bob went on the board, but Bill sort of called his state out of the thing, thinking it would be more interesting if he got on later on. But Bill was the kind that liked to work behind the background. Bill was a wonderful manipulator, if they'd let him. So with the new foundation being formed, with the idea of needing a lot of money, the drunk started again to solicit money, again from the very rich. They had a list of them and credentials and letters from friends of Mr. John D. Rockefeller, Jr., and they said, how can we miss? They asked themselves. The foundation had been formed in the spring of 1938, and all summer long they solicited the rich. Well, the rich were either in Florida or in Africa or in Hawaii or on a boat, and they preferred the Red Cross and the Salvation Army and their own pet charitable projects, and some thought that the drunks were too disgusting, and they did not get one single cent in the whole summer of 1938. Thank God they didn't. In the meantime, they began to have whole trustees meetings, and they were commiseration sessions of getting no money. And with the mortgage and Bill and Dr. Bob already paid, and Bill and Bob eating away what was left, the $5,000 now was gone, and they were all broke again. And Dr. Smith had trouble getting his practice back because patients were a little leery about being carved up by an alcoholic surgeon, even though that he was 3 years sober, and things were tough all around. Well, what are they going to do now? So one day in August of 1938, Bill produced at a foundation meeting a couple of chapters of a proposed book in the rough and in mimeograph. As a matter of fact, they've been using chapters of this book along with some recommendations from some of the physicians down at Johns Hopkins Medical Center in the psychiatric department and try to put the bite on the rich. And then Mr. Amos said, I know the religious editor down at Harper's. Why don't you take these two book chapters down to Harper's to Mr. Gene Axman? Bill, your story and an introduction to the book and see what he thinks about them. Because you see, originally, Dr. Silkworth's opinion was going to be chapter one and Bill's story chapter two. And to Bill's surprise, Mr. Axman, who became a great friend of Alcoholics Anonymous, looked at the chapters and asked Bill if he could write a whole book like this. And Bill didn't even bat an eye. He said, why, sure. Sure I can. Then Mr. Axman took the two chapters into Mr. Canfield's office, and another meeting was held, and the result was that Harper's intimated that they would pay Bill as a budding author $1,500 in advance royalties, bringing in enough money for Bill to finish the book. Well, at first Bill felt elated about it, but then after a while he didn't feel so good about it because Bill began to reason, and so did the other boys. Well, if this guy Wilson eats up the $1,500 while he's doing the book, and the book gets out, it'll take a long time to catch up. And if this thing gets all the publicity they believe that it would, what are they going to do about answering all the inquiries? And where are they going to get the money? And after all, what's a lousy 10% royalty anyway? Then they thought, too, that even though Harper's was a fine publisher, if this book, if and when done, should prove to be the main textbook of Alcoholics Anonymous, why would they want the main means of propagation in the hands of someone else? Then they reasoned, should we not control it? And well, at this point, the book project really began to take off. Why, what we ought to do, they said, is form a book company, a publishing company, incorporation. We'll call it Works Publishing Company. This being the first of great many works and how it works. And then they could sell stock certificates to all the drunks and then get some money coming in to support the author and the guy who collected the money and the gal who was helping Bill with the book. So they took this idea to the next trustees meeting, and the trustees all shook their heads and said no. Well, then they had an alcoholic rebellion, and the drunks told their non-alcoholic friends, well, after all, you have not produced any money, and by gosh, we're going to try this thing on separate from the foundation. So Bill had a drunk helping in on this thing, one super promoter by the name of Hank Parkhurst. And Hank was a super promoter, and at one time he was an executive with Standard Oil of New Jersey. He was their public relations director. And he said to Bill, this is simple. Come on with me. So they went out and they walked into a stationery store and they bought a pad of blank stock certificates and they wrote across the top of them, Works Publishing Company, par value $25. Then they took this pad of stock certificates. Of course, they didn't bother to incorporate it, and that didn't happen for a few years later on, and they took this thing into the next AA meeting where you're not supposed to mix money with spirituality. And they start hammering on the drunks and said, look here, this thing is going to be a cinch. Parkhurst will take a third of this thing for his services rendered. I, Bill, the author, will take a third as for what I'm doing as the author. And then as a result, and you drunk can have the other third of these stock certificates. Par value, $25. If you will just start paying up on your stock. And if you only want one share, $5 a month for 5 months. And then all the drunks gave Bill and Hank that cold look. And they said, what the heck? You mean to say that you're asking us to buy stock in a book that you haven't even written yet? Why, sure, they said. If Harper's will put money into this thing, why shouldn't you? They say it's going to be a good book. But the drunk said, no deal. So Hank and Bill started a new pitch at the drunks. They told them that they had been looking at the printing cost of the book. He said, we got a book here that'll be between 400 and 450 pages. It ought to sell for $3.50. Now back in those days, they found on inquiries from printers that a book that you're going to sell for $3.50, about 400 to 450 pages, could be printed for 35 cents a copy. And they got drunks got to figuring, well, if it's 35 cents a copy to print it, you're gonna sell it for $3.50, you're gonna make 1,000% profit. Of course they didn't mention to the drunks all the other costs and expenses. So they said, just think, boys, when these books move out in carload lots, we're printing them for 35 cents. We're going to sell them for $3.50 by direct mail. How can you lose? And the drunks said no. So Hank and Bill figured they had to have a better argument than that. How are we going to convince the drunks that we will move these books out in carload lots, millions and millions of dollars? So they get the idea to go up to Reader's Digest. And so they get an appointment with Mr. Payne, who then was the managing editor. Now, the way they got the appointment was this. Dr. Silkworth was renting a house from Mr. Walters. And Mr. Walters owned the Reader's Digest. And as Dr. Silkworth would send in his rent check to Mr. Mr. Williams owned it. Mr. Walters, who was the comptroller and treasurer, he'd send in copies of his opinion and Bill's story. And then hoping he would tell it to Mr. Williams, you know, and that's how they got the appointment with Mr. Payne. They got up there and they excitingly told him this exciting story of this new budding society, and they dwelled on their friendship of Mr. Rockefeller and Harry Emerson Fosdick, and the society was about to publish this textbook, and would this not be a matter of tremendous interest to the Reader's Digest? Of course, the drunks were thinking, with the Reader's Digest circulation in those days of about 12 million readers, so if they could just only get a free plug or an ad, that would really help move the book. Well, Mr. Payne liked the idea, and he asked Bill when the projected book would be finished. And then he would take the matter up with the editorial board, and when the time is right, he said, and you get the book all ready to shoot, come on up, and we'll put on a special feature writer on this thing. Well, this was all that Bill and Hank needed to hear. So they went back to the drunks and said, now look, boys, there are positively millions in this dollars in this thing for us. How can we miss? And after all, we only need $4,000 or $5,000. So they began to sell shares in Works Publishing, not yet incorporated, $5 a month to poor people. One guy bought 10 shares. They sold a few shares to some non-alcoholics. And Hank, who was very, very busy and very important in this deal, because he was the one who went out and kept collecting the money. So Bill and Ruthie Hawk, the secretary, could work on the book. And then Bill's wife, Lois, would have some groceries, although she wasn't taking any chances. She was still working in a department store. So the preparation started. Some more chapters were written, and they went into AA meetings in New York City with these chapters in the rough. And the drunks start chewing up the chapters apart, and Bill suddenly found himself in a whirlpool of argument. Bill was just the umpire, and he said, look, boys, over here, you've got all the holy rollers who say we need all this good old-fashioned stuff in the book. And over here, you say you have to have a psychological book, and that never toured anybody. And they didn't do much for the drunks and the missions. So I guess you'll just have to leave it to me to be the umpire. I'll scribble out some things here, and let's get in the comments. So they fought, bled, and died through one chapter of another. And what the New York bunch would do, they would write what they thought that had to be in the book or Bill did. They'd leave quadruple space, send it out to Akron for their comments, have the Akron bunch send it back, and then they would revise it. And also, but above all, the drunks in Akron's approval. That was very important. And once again, terrific hassles developed on what should go in the book. Meanwhile, drunks were set writing their stories, and then came that night when they got to chapter 5, because here is a point where the book had to say what this deal and thing was all about and how this thing works. As I said, it was originally a 6-step program, and one night, Bill, laying in bed, trying to think of what this chapter 5 should be all about, and then the idea came to Bill that they needed a definite statement, concrete principle that these drunks could not wiggle out of. There cannot be any wiggling out of this deal at all. And the 6-step program had 2 big gaps in it. Moreover, if this book goes out to distant readers, they had to have an absolute explicit program by which to go by. And while Bill was thinking about these things over, and while he was mad as a dickens because the drunks and the money was coming in too slow, there was a knock on the door, and Bill went to the door, and there were 2 drunks there. One was a member, brought in a brand new one to come talk to Bill, and asked Bill what he was doing, and Bill said he was busy. And they had a wait to go down to the old post office box, 658 Church Street Annex, the address printed in the back of the first printing of the Book of Alcoholics, not Big Red. And they hung to it for about 3 days, and they were getting real nervous. And then Hank, Ruthie, and Bill went over to the post office, and they looked in box 658. And it wasn't a lock box from the front, it's just an isinglass you looked in. Then you had to go to the postal clerk and ask him to bring the mail. And they could just see in there only a few of these postal cards. And Bill had a terrific sinking spell. But Hank, the super promoter, said, "Why, Bill, they can't put all that mail in that little bitty box. By God, they got mail bags full back there." So they go to the clerk, and they ask for their mail, and he brings out 12 lousy postal cards, 10 of them completely illegible, written by doctors drunk as monkeys, and they had exactly 2 orders for the book Alcoholics Anonymous, and they were absolutely and utterly and totally devastated, but all absolutely and totally broke. The sheriff then just moved in on the office. Poor Mr. Blackwell wondered what to do for money and felt like taking the book over. And at that opportune moment, the house in which the Wilsons were living in was foreclosed, and the Wilsons and their belongings and furniture was set out on the street. And that was the state of the book Alcoholics Anonymous in the summer of 1939. Then the Brooks started screaming, "Well, what about our $4,500? Colonel Towns was uneasy about his money. And what are they going to do now? So then they began to shop around from one magazine to another. Nobody bit. And it looked like the whole thing was going down the drain. However, one of the boys in New York City, who was a little prosperous at the time in the clothing business by the name of Bert Taylor, saved him. Bill went to see him and told him that there was a promise of the article in the Liberty magazine, but it wouldn't come out until the fall in September to be called Alcoholics and God, and written by Morris Markley, to be printed by Fulton Ousler, who was then the editor, the religious editor of that magazine. And he said, "We need $1,000 to get us through the summer." And Burke said, "I don't have the money, but I have a friend down in Baltimore, a Mr. Cochran. He's connected with the wet and dry forces." And Bill says, "Now here, wait a minute about this wet and dry business." Burke said, "Heck, Bill, when you're broke, you're not going to be fussy where you're going to get this $1,000, are you? Do you want the money or not? He's a customer of mine. I sell him pants, so let's call him up." So Bert gets on the phone and he calls Mr. Cochran and tells him, "You know, Mr. Cochran, from time to time I had mentioned to you about this alcoholic fellowship which I belong to. And Mr. Cochran, our fellowship has just come out with this magnificent new textbook, Sure Cure for Alcoholism. And it's something that we believe that every public library in this country should have. And the retail price of the book is $3.50. But if you will buy a couple of thousand of these books and put them in large public libraries, of course we would sell to you for that purpose these books at a considerable discount." Well, Mr. Cochran didn't buy that, so Bert then told him that some publicity about the book will come out in the fall. But in the meantime, he said, "We desperately need $1,000 to tie us over the summer. Would you loan the Works Publishing Company $1,000? Well, Mr. Cochran said, "Well, what does this Works Publishing Company's balance sheet look like?" And when he was told, he said, "No, thank you." Then Bert then asked, "Mr. Cochran, would you loan the money to me on the credit of my business?" "Well, sure," said Mr. Cochran. "Just send down and sign your personal note on your business." So Bert hocked his business. A year or two later, it was to go broke anyway. That saved the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And that lasted until the article came in. 800 inquiries came in, and as a result of that, they moved a few books. Barely squeaked through the year 1939, and by all this time, Nothing was heard from John D. Rockefeller, Jr. Meanwhile, foundation meeting after foundation meeting was held, and the trustees said, "Too bad you're having such a hard time getting any money, but we're not going to give you any money." When all of a sudden, about February 1940, Mr. Richardson came to a trustees meeting and announced that Mr. Rockefeller, who nothing had been heard from since 1937, had been watching all this time with immense interest. Moreover, they were told that Mr. Rockefeller Jr. would like to give this fellowship a dinner in which he would invite his friends to see the beginning of this new and prosperous start. And then Mr. Richardson produced the invitation list. And on the invitation list were the most prestigious and the wealthiest people that John D. Rockefeller knew in this country. There were chairmen of banks. Wendell Willkie, he was on it. John Foster Dulles was on it. You name it. Walter Chrysler, the president of Ford Motor Company. All of the, Mr. Kresge, all of these people, insurance companies, religious, top drawer people, and most of them extremely rich. And Bill took a list at that, a quick look at that list, and Bill figured out, my God, there must be a couple of $1 billion in that bunch. Well, the dinner came, and they got Harry Emerson Fosdick to review the AA book. He gave a wonderful plug. Foster Kennedy came and spoke of the medical attitude, and he's seen a very hopeless gal, Marty M. recover, one of his patients. Bill got up and talked about life among the anonymi and the bankers. 75 strong sat at the table that were intermixed with the alcoholics. Well, the bankers had come as a sort of a command performance, and they were a little suspicious. Perhaps this is another one of John D. Rockefeller Jr.'s prohibition deals. But they warmed up under the influence of the drunks sitting at the tables, and Morgan Ryan was asked at his table by a very distinguished banker, "Why, Mr. Ryan, we presume that you are in the banking business." "No," Mr. Ryan said, "not at all. I'm just out of the Greystone Insane Asylum." But unfortunately, Mr. Rockefeller could not get to the dinner. He was quite ill, and he sent his son, a wonderful man, Nelson Rockefeller, in his place instead. And after the show was over with, and the drunks were ready for the big touch, Nelson Rockefeller got up and, speaking in behalf of his father, said, "My father sends word that he is so sad and sorry that he cannot be here with you tonight. But he is so glad and thrilled that so many of his friends are present who can see the beginning of this great and wonderful thing." Something Nelson Rockefeller said that has affected his father's life more than anything else. A stupendous plug that was. Then said Nelson Rockefeller, "But fortunately, gentlemen, this is the work that proceeds on goodwill. It requires no money." And whereupon the $2 billion got up and walked out. Again, the hand of Providence intervened. Right after the dinner, Mr. Rockefeller asked that the talks be published in a pamphlet. He approached the rather defunct Works Publishing Company and said he would like to buy 400 books to send to all of his friends that had come to the dinner and all who had not. Seeing that this was a good purpose, they let him have the books cheap. He bought them cheaper than anybody else has ever bought them. They sold 400 books to John D. Rockefeller Jr. for $1 apiece. And with the books and pamphlets, he sent a personally written letter, and he personally signed every one of them. And in this letter, he again recited how glad he was that his friends had been able to see this great beginning of what he thought would be a wonderful plug and a wonderful thing, how deeply it affected him. And then he said, "This fortunately is a work of goodwill. It needs little, if any, money. perhaps a slight of temporary help, and I am giving these good people $1,000. Well, when the rich people received Mr. Rockefeller's letter, they all added it up on the cuff. Well, if John Jr. is given $1,000, he's a billionaire, and me with only maybe about $800 or $900 million, I'm going to send these people just about $10. One who had an alcoholic relative sent in $300. So all told, as a result of that dinner, they got together $3,000, which was the first outside contribution to the Alcoholic Foundation. That money was divided equally between Bill and Dr. Bob so they could keep going, and somehow they solicited that dinner list for 5 years at the average of $3,000 a year, and at the end of that time, in 5 years, they were able to say to Mr. Rockefeller, "Thank you so much for your generosity, but we do not need any more money. The book income is helping to support our office. The groups are contributing to fill in. The royalties from the book are taking care of Dr. Bob and Bill Wilson. And thank you, we don't need any more outside money." Now, you have to remember the outside money came in before our traditions were written. Now, for those of you who may be interested, Alcoholics Anonymous, Works Publishing, is the only recipient of Rockefeller money that's ever repaid it back 100%. A tremendous thing, isn't it? It's the only one that's ever repaid it, every bit of it. Now, maybe you can see that they paid it back to the Rockefellers, that Mr. Rockefeller's decision not to give us money saved this society. He gave of himself. He gave of himself at a time when he was under public ridicule for his views about alcohol. He said to the whole world, "This thing is good." The story went out on the wires all over the world. People ran into the bookstores to get the new book. An awful lot of inquiries came into the little office on Vesey Street, and the book money began to pay for an additional helper. And then comes Jack Alexander with his terrific article in the Saturday Evening Post. And then came an immense flood of inquiries, 6,000 or 7,000, and Alcoholics Anonymous has become a national institution. And such is the story of the preparation of the book Alcoholics Anonymous and the history involved within, and of its subsequent effect, who all of us right here this morning have some notion. The proceeds from that book has repeatedly saved the office and Alcoholics Anonymous, believe it or not. But it isn't the money that came out of it that matters. It is the message that this book carries in it that has transcended the mountains and the seas, and is even at this moment lighting candles in dark caverns and in distant lands where our kind live. And I'd like to close this with a little letter that was written to Bill by Hank Parkhurst. "Dear Bill, I'm rushing off to you excerpts from a letter just received from Mr. Thomas Uzell, former editor of Collier's Magazine, writer of several books, contributor to Collier's Saturday Evening Post, and so forth. As you know, hardly a year goes past when one of Mr. Uzell's writings do not appear on the best bookseller list. Incidentally, this might be interesting to you, such books as The Good Earth, If I Had Four Apples, The Outward Room, three Book of the Month Club books, and bestsellers for months after publishing, were submitted to him for criticism and final designing. In the publishing and literary world, I know there is no one so well established and looked up to as Mr. Uzell. I've gone to considerable length in regard to this because the following portion of this letter has made me so glad and so enthusiastic. Mr. Uzell says, quote, "I spent last evening with the manuscript. I knew, of course, what the document was, But on reading additional chapters and surveying the job as a whole, I found myself deeply moved at times, full of amazement, almost incredibly. And during most of the reading, I was extremely sympathetic. My feeling at the moment is that you certainly hold on to the production and distribution of this volume if you can. For she ought to go far, wide, and handsome, and net those concerned a neat profit. You have here an extremely urgent problem. You have a successful defiance of medicine. You have a religious story. You have a deeply human story. And lastly and above all, you have a whole flock of happy endings. My God, I don't know what else you could want for a good book. I believe in it most emphatically. Yes, the whole book needs the final shaping of a professional hand, and incidentally, a well-kept trivia piece. It was Mr. Uzel who shaped up the book after it went in. He was paid $800 for it. Yeah. He didn't disturb any of the thinking, but he just cleaned up some of the grammar and et cetera and et cetera. But it is interesting that he ends his letter, Hank, says as follows, quote, "I understand better now the enthusiasm you revealed in your talks with me about this work. I thought you were exaggerating somewhat, but now I have joined the core invisible." Bill, if I were you, Hank said, I would be intensely proud of this opinion. Let's have a break now, and I want to thank you for your attention and attendance, and we'll reconvene here in about 15 minutes. Thank you very, very, very much. We've already gone through the history of writing of our book, and so the rest of the morning and this afternoon, my role will be to share AA's experience and Alcoholics Anonymous experience in our Wiley work. We hear it read all the time how it works, but Wiley work is so important in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, we hear it read all over the world, more so than a portion of Chapter 5 all over the world. You have to remember that Alcoholics Anonymous exists not only in our own home group, but it also exists every place, everywhere. The sun never sets on Alcoholics Anonymous. In Alcoholics Anonymous, a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other, and they solve their common problem and help others recover from alcoholism, which is nothing more than a combination of traditions 1 and 5. The only requirement for membership is desire to stop drinking. Tradition 3, there are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting to our own contributions. Tradition 7, AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Tradition 6, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Tradition 10, our primary purpose and the only reason that Alcoholics Anonymous is here, and the only reason, basically, that we are sober, even though we may want to tend to put conditions on it. And our primary purpose as individuals and collectively is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. You know, every alcoholic that comes to AA today, although many come to Alcoholics Anonymous, they don't realize they're an alcoholic until after they get AA. Maybe they either drank too much, drank crazy, did this or that. But we're talking about the nature of the illness. Everyone that comes to us today is automatically given 3 gifts or 3 legacies. This was not so when Alcoholics Anonymous got started. All they had was just the recovery program, the 12 steps. And as AA began to explode and to grow after Jack Alexander's article, and in the middle 40s, groups were becoming all things for all people. Whole groups were getting disintegrated. Whole groups were breaking up. Whole groups, members were returning back to drinking in mass volume. And the sober members of AA that were very concerned went to Bill and said, Bill, do something. And so Bill sat down and wrote 12 more principles. which we now know as our traditions, and then later on our 12 more principles, the 12 concepts of world service. And so they're called our three legacies, but the legacy of service, not necessarily the 12 concepts of world service. That was written after the third legacy was formed, which third legacy is nothing more than the authorization, creation, formation, and development of our General Service Conference. But the second legacy of unity, you know, very implicitly throughout AA's traditions is admission that our fellowship has its defects. Now, that's not hard to understand because we're composed of 100% defects. There are no well folks in Alcoholics Anonymous. And we admit that we not only have character defects as a society, but that these defects threaten us continuously. And so our traditions are the guide as a result of bitter experience. Our traditions were not written because of our good behavior. They were written because of our bad behavior. And they're the better guide to better ways of working and living, and they're also the medicine for our various group sicknesses. And don't think groups get sick. Whole groups get sick. In the early days of Alcoholics Anonymous, they had a group that didn't have any women in it. And they got a call from a gal that was out in a tourist court. Now, that's what they called them in those days. And she was drunk, and she had heard about Alcoholics Anonymous, and she wanted somebody to try to come out and help her. Well, they didn't have any gals to go out and help her. They were sober. So one of the gallant blades in the group decided to go out and 12-step her. And 2 days later, he hadn't come back. So they sent another member of the group out to check on him and the gal, and they found them both drunk. Well, the one that sent out to check on the first one, he didn't come back. So they sent a third one to go out and check on the three of them. They found three of them drunk, and this went on and on and on. And finally, they only had one member left in the group. He's the only sober one. And he got lonesome telling himself his own story every night. So he decided to go check out on the group. He went out, found them all drunk. He said, well, the group's drunk, gal's drunk, I might as well get drunk. He got drunk, and the whole group got sober, and the gal got sober, although she's not the longest continuing active sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous today. She's one of the early ones. And so, as a result, you know, the 12 traditions are also to group survival and harmony. What A's 12 steps are to our individual sobriety and peace of mind. But the 12 traditions also point straight at many of our individual defects. For our practical application, they ask us for personal as well as group sacrifice, and that's the hardest thing in the world in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's utterly amazing how stupid and ignorant we are about living sober before we get here, and how brilliant we are about trying to change up the program, about bringing in things that have nothing to do with Alcoholics Anonymous. People who are very, all of a sudden they become very fervent in their faith after becoming members of AA, and you ask them to go on a 12-step call and they won't go. And yet on birthday nights, you know, they get up, and it's utterly amazing how many meetings you go into, and that people will talk about, you know, and you go into one of those closed discussion meetings, and the topic is, and somebody says, and here it comes, World War VIII, something, the chairman said, now what does anybody want to talk about tonight? Now that opens up a can of worms, and they say, oh, this has been a bad day. This has been so bad, my God, it's been the worst day. And the next one said, you think your day is bad? Let me tell you about mine. And God help the 30th one when it gets around to him about a bad day. And yet we got guts enough to stand up here when a new one comes and say, if you decide you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. You understand? And so as a result, you know, they ask for personal as well as group sacrifice. Because here is the thing. They ask us, because this is the vehicle on which a problem drinker comes and learns how to live sober in the world. And in AA, to stay sober is to live, and to drink is to die. And we become derelict when we don't give them the best shot, regardless of what it is. Because the tradition just simply asks us to never use the AA name in any personal quest for our power, distinction of money, and the traditions, here comes one of the most important guarantees, the equality of all members and the independence of all groups. We are a society of equals. If we listen to the stories very carefully, they're all basically the same. We couldn't stay sober, we couldn't stay drunk, we couldn't kill ourselves, we couldn't stay alive. You can compare yourself right out of the door of Alcoholics Anonymous, period. We get down to the nitty-gritty of being a human being, because ours is an inside job. It's not outside. And then as a result of it, you know, and then after we get here, then we become really, truly a society of equals because we're all spiritually ill. There are no well folks. Regardless of what kind of background and brain we've ever had. That's the reason why AA is composed of every facet of human life. There are members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And also the independence of all groups. It gives the group the freedom, the same freedom that it gives members of Alcoholics Anonymous when we come in here. We come in here as members, we either do the deal and face the consequences, or we don't do the deal and face the consequences. Either way around, we're going to have to face the consequences. An AA group either lives by the principles and faces the consequences, or it doesn't. And face the consequences. Either way around, we're going to have to face the consequences. Because the traditions reveal to us how we can best relate to ourselves, to each other, to the world in which we live. And so for the sake of the welfare of our entire society, our traditions just simply request that every member, every district, every area, every region, every country, and Alcoholics Anonymous to lay aside all that desires and ambitions and unwanted actions that could bring serious division among us or for lose of us the confidence of the world at large. Many, many years ago, when the United Nations moved from San Francisco to its present headquarters in New York City, and one of the earlier meetings when it got to New York City, they had a very important meeting. And present was the then former living President of the United States, Herbert Hoover. And he was there to deliver a very extremely important policy talk. And right in the middle of his talk, he stopped and he made a 180-degree turn. And he said, if the world would live by the most perfect set of principles that has come to his attention, that this would be the finest world that God would ever know. Now, there's no known document, and that's the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, there's no known documentation that Herbert Hoover or any of his blood kin or emotionally attached were members of AA and later on members of any of our cooperating fellowships. And if you're busy in AA and go to a lot of meetings and sooner or later you're a sponsor and this and that and you meet a lot of people in various professions and et cetera and et cetera. And as I talked earlier morning about the invitational list of those who were invited to John D. Rockefeller's Jr. that was given for our fellowship at the Union Club in February of 1940, and I happen to have a copy of that. And the drunks, as I told you, were going to hit up all those wealthy folks for money. And the drunks would put names after, certain quotations rather, after each name. This one is tight. Stay away from him. This one's pocketbook is loose. This one is a prohibitionist. This one's a wide-eyed evangelist. And right after one name were these words, perhaps Herbert Hoover's best personal friend. Well,